this is Daniel Jalkut.
Hi, and this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, Someone Had a Bet with Tim Cook. Well, Manton, it was more or less just like regular WWDC for me, I guess, because I normally skipped so many sessions. I think you were usually a bit more studious than I.
Usually, but I was thinking about this morning. We're recording the week after WWDC, and I think at the end of this week, I will probably have watched more sessions than I normally do going to the conference. Because, you know, you go to the conference and you attend the sessions, and then you're lazy and you don't actually go and rewatch a lot of the ones you missed. But because I missed all of them at the conference, I feel compelled to watch a bunch of them. So I've seen many sessions now. And the fact that Apple has released them so quickly is really huge. It made a huge difference in my ability to stay up to date with what was actually going on at the conference.
That's really interesting. I think there's something psychological there, because I kind of have it too, where it's like, if I was officially at the conference, and even if I missed a session, I sort of like have it in my mind that I already, quote, went to WWDC. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, oh, I didn't go to any of this stuff. So yeah, I don't know what it is exactly, but I think I have a similar feeling to you, where it's like, I better catch up on some of this stuff. I better get in there and check out these videos. It did help also that they came out so quickly. I felt like it's still the time to be watching these videos, right? Mm-hmm. Like, whereas even when they came out a week later, or you know, especially when they came out months later, but even when they come out like a week or two later, I've sort of already switched contexts, I guess. And
yeah.
And now I'm still kind of in that, you know, I'm giving myself some time to install Mavericks, to install iOS 7, play around with this stuff. And this is the kind of time where, you know, in a few weeks from now, I'm probably going to be at that point where I'm like back into full on underwater working on whatever the latest emergency is.
Yeah. No, you're right. The difference between releasing the videos the same day, which is what they did really every night, they released them, and even I would say 5 or 6 days later, is everything. That made a huge difference. And I was really impressed with Apple's ability to actually do that. There's a ton of sessions every day. To actually turn those out every day, I was surprised and impressed they did it.
It's borderline live. It feels like it almost feels like live with like a buffer, right?
And it was as good as live for the most part. I mean, they did stream the keynote live, so I watched that live Monday morning, and I was going to go to all WWDC to hang out with folks and catch up on the news. But when I saw they were streaming it live, and maybe I slept in a little bit. And I know they had to turn people away that morning at Alt WWDC a little bit. So I stayed in the hotel and streamed it live. And that was actually kind of my routine. I mean, every morning I would just kind of watch sessions and catch up on things. And then I would venture out and do everything else I wanted to do while at the conference.
Yeah, that's similar for me. I actually enjoyed the phenomenon of watching on the treadmill at the hotel gym a session from the day earlier's WWDC. And I got to say, Apple's generosity to those of us who did not buy a ticket is so great that it's really making me feel pretty good about, you know, not buying one, especially since, you know me, I spend my own money on it. So it's $1,600 that I can now put into, you know what, I don't know, towards a new Mac, towards, you know, all the other expenses, and mm-hmm. not to mention, you know, actually keeping my family alive. But it's increasingly hard for me to justify now. Like, having had this experience this year, it drove home for me that, oh, I went to WWDC. I saw a lot of people that I know. Mm-hmm. I even saw some folks who I was afraid I wouldn't see because they're inside Apple. I didn't see everybody I wished I could have, because it's true. Some people just hang out in the halls and or the labs, and you don't see them outside at the parties or the bars or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty darn good approximation. And the Alt-WWDC, I didn't even end up spending as much time there as I expected that I would. But being able to go over there, see a session, have just like a kind of like common meeting ground was great. What a service they are providing.
Yeah, I was really impressed. I didn't, like you, I didn't go over there as much as I wanted to, but I went over there Monday afternoon. I saw your panel, got to catch up and talk with people, and I was just really impressed with the way they ran it. Like you said, free event. Just, you know, it was packed every day, it seemed like, from what I heard on the other days that I wasn't there. And just a really nice gesture, you know, from the community to the community and people who couldn't attend the conference. And, you know, I think you're right. The feel, I was worried about how it would feel, let's say, Tuesday and Wednesday without a ticket. But the feel was very much like, and I'm talking about just being in San Francisco, not just all WWDC. The feel was very much like I'm attending WWDC. I mean, I would say most of the, you know, of the day was kind of the same or similar kind of things as you would normally have. Going out to lunch with folks, catching up with people in the evenings, watching sessions, though in this case not live. So it felt a lot the same as in previous years. And I mean, of course, there were things I missed. I really enjoy watching the Apple Design Awards live. Missed that. I like Stump the Experts. I know some people don't care for it, but I really like the history and the and just sort of, I don't know, it's a fun show. I didn't attend that for the first time in, you know, however many years. So yeah, there's things that you miss catching up with people in the hallway that you're not going to see on the street maybe, but I ran into almost everybody that I wanted to say hi to. So a few people I didn't see, and I didn't think about it until I was already, you know, on the flight back home that I'd missed them. But for the most part, it was a great week, and it was excellent.
Isn't that incredible how, you know, you meet so many people and see so many people, and then it goes by in a blur, and then I had the same kind of experience. It's like on the flight home is the first opportunity you have to like sit down and reflect on what actually happened this week. Like, right. Wait a minute, what whirlwind did I just allow myself to be, you know, spun through? And it's always a little disappointing, but I just have to, I mean, it's always a little disappointing, the people, for instance, that I didn't meet. And it's really easy to be ambitious before you go, like, oh, I'm definitely going to get coffee with you and get lunch with you and we're all going to see each other. And then you just start adding it up. And it's a good thing, Manton, we weren't going to any sessions, because that would have just made that even that much less possible. But
yeah, and it was an interesting week for me, too, because everything was shifted back a little bit. So I left to go home on Thursday morning. And for the past few years, I have been leaving on Friday anyway, so it was only kind of a day before that. But that, even just that extra day or 2 days, because some people stay through the weekend, shifted things a little bit so that the week was over kind of before I knew it. But it worked out well. As I mentioned on the previous show, I wanted to go early for the app.net hackathon, so I had an early flight Saturday morning to get there, arrived before lunch, and spent all day at the app.net hackathon, and that was excellent. It was like, at the end of that day, I was like, wow, this week has already been perfect. Like, this has already been worth the trip. So it was, I'm really glad I did that and was able to catch up with a bunch of those folks.
Yeah. I heard there were a ton of people at that app.net event. Oh, yeah. Was it like 70 people or something?
I don't know, but that, I wouldn't be surprised. We can link up. They did a good blog post, kind of wrap up with things that people were working on in photos and stuff, and we can link that in the show notes. But yeah, I had a great time, and there's a bunch of folks from the app.net community and developers that I had never met before. I would say most of them I had never met before, actually. And so it was great to meet those people and hang out with them then, and then also, you know, during the week.
Yeah, I know they had like a meetup during the week, but I missed that. But I was glad I got to go down and actually finally meet Dalton.
Cool.
And just great. Always chatting with him. This guy has a real, idea of what he's doing. It's really cool to just chat with him. And like, you know, Manton, we've been following app.net now since before they launched. And if we went back and listened to our earliest thoughts about it, I believe we were both just like, yeah, this will never happen. Right. Yeah. We're both like tentatively supported it, but we're like, we'll see. Yeah,
quite skeptical.
Good job, dreamer. Right? Right. You keep your head in the clouds. We'll be right down here near the ground, and let us know how that works out for you. And it's right. It's been working out pretty well. Little did we know that you know, a year later, they would be, as far as I can tell, as successful as anybody could hope, and. Mm-hmm. And Manton Rees switched full time to their service from Twitter.
Yep.
So good job, dreamers.
Yeah, it's, you know, the timing, you know, my last post to Twitter was in October. So coming up on, you know, over half a year, almost a year now, I guess. And at the time, the timing worked out well because I was frustrated with what Twitter was doing with the, you know, the token limits and just all the other guidelines and things where they were really discouraging developers. And I wasn't quite sure at the time if app.net, where it would be, you know, a year from now. But it's worked out great. And Dalton and those guys, their attitude toward developers is perfect. You know, it's the exact opposite of what we're used to with Twitter. But the thing that's impressed me the most is that the scope of app.net, and this really, like at the hackathon, this really drives this point home. And the scope is just way beyond what I thought. When we were talking about this a year ago, the scope is just much bigger. The API is way more advanced than certainly the Twitter API and most other web services API, the types of apps you're going to be able to build with this thing. It's interesting to look back, thinking about kind of our skepticism at the beginning, and then also the scope of what they built now. If you actually go back to listen to what Dalton was saying a year ago, he actually kind of had that, like you said, he kind of had this figured out. He kind of had this all planned, and it's slowly rolled out. And in hindsight, looking back, you can say, wow, he actually had the vision for how this was going to play out. And it's pretty cool to see it happening.
Yeah, indeed. So apart from you know, our various meetups and parties and all that, the one thing that sort of unified the experience for us, as with all the attendees, was the keynote. And like you said, you watched it from your hotel room. I also watched it from my hotel room. It was one of those things where I was like ambitious about going over to Alt-WWDC, but then it was like 9:30, 9:45, 9:50. Mm-hmm. Oh, I haven't showered. I'm probably not going to go over there. Yeah. And it was a little bit iffy. Here's the funny thing. I didn't realize that there was like a secret magic Wi-Fi code for the hotel.
What?
And I guess you didn't either until just now.
I paid $16 a day for the quote unquote premium Wi-Fi, and no regrets. It was perfect. Well, and it sounds like a lot, but compared to $1,600, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a few regrets because there's like this like small collection of magical Wi-Fi codes that just like unlock the freeness. And it sort of pisses me off about the hotel that these exist. But yeah, I was complaining because so getting back to the keynote, I watched the keynote live streaming through the tethering on my phone.
Oh, I see.
Because I had worked it out and I'm like, you know what? You know, LTE or whatever is fast enough, and hotel Wi-Fi is not, you know, famously not very great usually. And right. I was like, well, so I'll pay overage fees on my tethering. And I watched it. It was a little, there was a little bit like, or moments I think that were like, uh-oh, this is going out. But I don't think it was based on my tethering. I think it was just, you know, everybody in the world was watching this thing. But then I found out like 3 days later, I'm like complaining to somebody, well, I haven't really downloaded Xcode, or I haven't really watched, you know, too many sessions because, you know, I'm on my tethering. And they're like, oh, just use pumpkin puree as the password. I'm like, and lo and behold, actually, for future reference, Park 55, San Francisco, just give it a go. All lowercase, Golden Gate.
Okay.
Now, doesn't that sound like the kind of code that they just have open all the time?
Probably so. Yeah.
The bastards. Right? I mean, come on, $16 a day, or you just, I don't know, what do you wink at the check-in person and they're like, Golden Gate. You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I missed that.
Yeah, anyway, sorry, Manton. I didn't want to destroy your memories of the week with that.
Well, I mean, even the $16, I mean, it's ridiculous to pay that much for Wi-Fi, but
yeah,
it's priceless to pay to watch the keynote live for only $16.
Right.
So, and it, like I said, actually, it was, like you said, usually the Wi-Fi in a hotel, forget about it. It's terrible.
Yeah.
To their credit, worked great. I think in the 2 hours, it dropped the stream a couple times, and I reloaded it, and it was right back. So worked well.
And let's flip this around a little bit. Probably what happened is there's some special deal or some like promotion where you're supposed to have booked your room through a special deal, and and I didn't actually do that. I was probably technically, along with whoever else had this code, probably piggybacking on something I wasn't supposed to.
Next, you'll be downloading the iOS 7, you know, via BitTorrent or whatever the kids are doing these days.
That's right. Who needs an iOS? Who needs an ADC membership, right? Well, I'm still legit in that respect anyway. All right, Manton. Well, one of the other cool things we did at WWDC, one of the things that sustained us in our ticketless state was the great party put on by the folks at Crashlytics, who are, of course, our recurring sponsor here on Core Intuition. Both of you and I ended up going to this party. It was a great time. Got to finally meet some of the founders that we hadn't met, or you had met them in Austin. I hadn't met Wayne. And I know Matt from, Matt's not a founder, but our friend Matt here in Boston. So I guess we should, since this is a sponsorship message, we should also recap what Crashlytics is. Crashlytics, of course, is crash reporting framework for iOS. You drop it into your Xcode project and ship that release, and suddenly all your crashes are getting reported directly to Crashlytics' servers, where you can browse them, look at them with really nice stack crawls showing exactly where the crash is based, and hopefully get those crashes fixed.
Yeah, great service. I've been using this for a while now. It's probably almost a year in Tweet Library, and I've been doing a couple bug fix updates, and I get an email when there's some crashes. They send me an email, let me know where the crashes are, and the emails are actually useful. Like, a lot of times you sign up for a service and you get an email that just has like a link in it or something. The email actually has like, here's where the top crashes are for the last day, or however they aggregate it, and then you can click through to see even more information if you want. But so it's a great service. I'm still really happy with it, and they had some news, I guess, in the last couple of weeks since our last sponsorship ran. They have expanded to Android in addition to iOS. So that should be really good news for anyone who has a product on both, or they're thinking about experimenting with Android. It's nice to have one solution that actually works on both the mobile platforms.
Definitely. And I know lots of folks listening to this show are, primarily iOS developers, but a lot of folks also are developing for both platforms. It's very common these days to have mobile developers with a stake in each of these major platforms. So if you are somebody who has been happy using Crashlytics on iOS, the good news is now you can pop that same stuff over to your Android projects, or you can tell your Android friends about this great framework. Thanks again, Crashlytics, as usual, for your continued sponsorship of the show. And you can learn more at Crashlytics.com.
All right, Daniel, let's jump back into the keynote topics, because we touched on that briefly. But since then, it's been a week. I'd say I'm starting to get iOS 7 a little more now. It took me a little while. I did put it on my phone.
On your main phone?
I put it on my main phone, not while at the conference, because that sounds like a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Well, I actually need to use my phone. But as soon as I got home, I decided to put it on. I don't have a real test device that can actually run this thing anymore. My iPod Touch is too old that I used to use for testing betas. I never upgraded to the iPhone 5. I still love the 4S. I plan to keep it until they don't support it with iOS 8. And so I just said, yeah, I'll just put it on my main phone. It was either that or buy a new iPod Touch. And I just didn't feel like I could justify that at the moment.
Well, I'm still thinking about this. I haven't installed it yet, partly because I haven't decided whether I want to sully my iPhone 4, which I still have around. Even though officially you're not supposed to be able to downgrade, the word on the street is that you can downgrade. And I think this is usually the way it goes, that Apple actually supports, kind of a hush-hush way, supports downgrading during the beta period. I think that the risk then is that you leave this thing on your phone too long and suddenly it's not, beta time anymore. You might indeed be stuck with iOS 7 or later on the phone. There's also, of course, always these other options like Tiny Umbrella. You can kind of like spend a lot of time, possibly waste a lot of time figuring out all these different hacks for, enabling downgrades on your phones. And I'm never quite certain just how up to date they are with supporting stuff. So long story short, I have not put this on my main phone and I'm afraid to put it on the 4 because I'm worried that the 4 is so underpowered that it won't be a great test environment. But
yeah, I think that's fair. There's some things that don't work on the 4, I think, like some of the translucency and the sort of blurring effects and stuff.
The parallax, I think. Maybe
right, and that's an important part, I think, of what Apple is doing. I wrote a blog post yesterday about this, comparing it to the Disney's old like multi-plane camera for 2D animation. And I think that without some of those effects, I think you do miss something. And maybe when you're designing your app, maybe you're not going to get it quite right.
Right.
That's the thing that's so fascinating to me about this is, when the shock of the keynote sort of wore off, the realization that everybody is going to have to update their apps. Like, no app is going to be able to escape at least a little bit. I mean, maybe games and apps that just don't even try to look anything like iOS. But for most normal apps, everything is going to need to be touched a little bit, at least recompiled and tweaked, if not actually redesigned.
Yeah. Well, don't forget apps that suck. They don't need to update.
That's true. Apps that haven't even been updated for the iPhone 5 screen.
Right. I'm excited to, you know how it is with me. I'm always like teetering at that edge of being an actual iOS developer. So it's not as compelling to me as, for example, I have installed Mavericks OS 10 because, that's where my products that make my money live. So I'm like, I'm the kind of guy who's always like, okay, if I can get these bugs, let's say that there are bugs with my apps on OS 10 Mavericks, if I can get them fixed 9 months before or 6 months before the OS is even out, then there's a really great chance that all of my users will have the fix before they download.
Right.
So I know some people are like, well, you'll get your fixes when OS 10.9 comes out. And I that frankly baffles me. Like, as a user myself who tends to install 10.9 ahead of time, obviously, to start to debug it and get used to it, I'm always really frustrated with these companies who are like, we will have a fix on day one.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you, why? Like, I understand some problems are hard to fix, but if you can fix your bugs now, same thing applies for iOS 7. You're going to have some power users out there, first of all, who are going to be excited to have your bugs fixed ahead of time. But the bottom line being, like, especially on iOS where, until this automatic app updating thing comes with iOS 7, my impression is that version stagnation is extremely common. And I'm guilty of it too. I have 50 updates available on my phone, and it's one of those, well, if it's not broke, don't fix it things.
Yep.
But if I let that thing sit around until iOS 7 comes out, I'm sure a lot of that stuff's going to be broken. So,
yep. And I've already, I'm not going to leave like reviews in the App Store and say, this doesn't work with iOS 7. I'm not going to be a jerk like that. But there are, I would say, two or three apps that I use almost every day that are broken on iOS 7. And in small kind of ways, like they're not, like one of them is unusable and the other is like kind of small glitches. So like you're scrolling and then things don't update and anymore, and you know, things you can kind of, they're annoying, but you can work around. But yeah, those apps should be able to do hopefully minor bug fix updates in the next month or so that also sort of clean up a couple of these things.
Right.
But the other problem with iOS 7, and so the same thing on the Mac, I mean, and I think maybe even more so on the Mac, apps should be able to roll out an update that addresses any compatibility problems. I think the iOS 7 is maybe a weird case because a lot of people are going to do a new version of their app for iOS 7. Like they're going to release an app that only works on iOS 7, like a 2.0 of their app. And when I first heard people start play with this idea, like on Monday or Tuesday, I was like, that doesn't work. You know, you should still support iOS 7 and 6. And, you know, just at runtime, you make some checks, you do the right thing with the appearance or, you know, custom code path for iOS 7. So it looks good. But the more I talked to other developers and the more I dug into the APIs and the documentation and watched the videos, the more I'm actually convinced a lot of people are going to do this. They're going to use iOS 7 as an opportunity to do a major upgrade, whether it's paid or free, that does not work on iOS 6.
Yeah, and this is my master plan coming to fruition, because who's the smart guy who never released anything for iOS 2 through 6? Yeah. Right? I think I'm also going to leave all of my past iOS releases behind and adopt iOS 7.
Yeah. Well, certainly if someone's working on a brand new app today that they're not going to ship next week, just make it iOS 7.
Yeah, I'll be lucky.
Unless you need to support like really old, like iPod Touch or iPad 1.
I'll be lucky if mine isn't iOS 8 only, right? So what else went down in the keynote that was of interest to you, Manton? I mean, it's all kind of become a blur already now. I definitely am not too excited about those automatic remote control cars. Cool demo, but it was a demo that made me immediately question the sanity of the Apple executive team,
right,
for including it in the keynote.
And not just including it, but including it at the beginning of the keynote. I was like, is this the best you've got? This is a weird place to start. I was also confused, but I was just so thrilled that they pulled the demo off.
Yeah.
That I'm willing to just kind of forgive it, because there was a point there, and we're like, what, like 5 or 10 minutes into the biggest keynote, you know, of the year, possibly the biggest keynote Apple's done in years. And it just, you know, totally, totally goes off. And there was definitely concern that this was just going to go down in flames. But they pulled it off. Cool under pressure, guy. So but, congrats
but,
to
but
them.
Like, why one developer featured? And why, it's, you know what it felt like to me? It felt like somebody had a bet with Tim Cook and was like, you know, I don't envision Tim Cook like getting drunk at a bar and like making a bar bet. But Tim Cook is like, no way can you hit a bullseye with that one dart from 20 feet. I'll tell you what, you know, and Tim Cook is like drunk at a bar and makes the mistake of promising a keynote feature if they do it. And then like, much to his surprise, they nail it. And then it's like, well, there you go. We're going to have a keynote that's 1 hour and 55 minutes jam-packed of the greatest stuff Apple has been working on for the past year and your remote control cars, because I lost this bar bet.
Yeah, that's as good an explanation as anything. You know, and I don't know if, you know, maybe if Scott Forstall had been around, there would have been a parade of 5 or 10 developers, because that seemed like the classic thing he would do, is parade the developers out, third-party developers showing off stuff. But he's gone, so one developer, that's all you get.
I have another theory, since you mentioned Scott Forstall. What if, there's a couple theories. I'll just mention one of the other ones off the cuff. Came from someone on Twitter who I unfortunately can't credit, but it's obvious in retrospect that Apple's featuring of these cars was a kind of a friendly jab at Google's self-driving cars.
Okay.
That has some, it's weird, but it's still.
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with anything. I mean, that's even, it's more strange than, I don't know.
It's weird. It's weird, but.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing is, since you mentioned Scott Forstall, what if there was like some old like executive meeting or something and they met up with these remote control cars people and Scott was like really down on them or something. Was like, yeah. This is the stupidest thing ever. This is really stupid. We're never going to work with you. You guys are dead to us. And then what if this was some kind of like part of the great burial of Scott's legacy?
Yeah.
I don't know. It smells like something's going on that we don't understand.
It's possible. Yeah. And that's the thing. It made so little sense in the context of the keynote that we're just guessing.
Yeah.
So, but what did you think of that? Because there were several jabs, I guess, at the legacy of Scott Forstall and the, you know, the jokes about the textures and the felt and all that. What did you think about how Apple handled that?
I am of two divided, extremely divided minds about this, because mm-hmm. there's the sassy Daniel punk ass part that is like, yeah, I hated that. I hated those paper bits on that calendar. I hated that felt, green felt on the game center.
Yeah.
And if this is the person to blame, then yeah, let's like kind of roast him a little bit. Let's rub it in. And that feels kind of good. And that's at odds with the part of me that kind of doesn't like to publicly shame people, the part that doesn't think it's appropriate for Apple to do it, the part that and also the part that, you know, I know Scott personally from having worked under him mm-hmm. at Apple, and I didn't agree with everything he chose to do at the company, but he did do and make choices that were right for the company. And so mm-hmm. then I think in the final equation, I think my complicated feelings are that I think it's a good idea at this juncture for Apple to be moving forward without Scott having as much, obviously any influence as it happens. But I think it's a good idea that they are refocusing on this new aesthetic, and that if Scott was going to be getting in the way of that, then it's appropriate that he's not involved anymore. But I do get a little uncomfortable with the extent when it starts to feel like he's a whipping boy, right? When it's like, well, let's just, it starts to feel a little bit like, and to be fair, nobody on stage said, you know, well, we got rid of all these Scottisms, you know, nobody said that. It just has become part of the understood interpretation of why Scott is not there anymore. That it has a lot to do with these aesthetic issues.
Right. Yeah, I have a theory about this, and it's not totally developed yet, but I'll share it. And I say this, but at first I should say that iOS 7, I've really warmed up to it. I really like what they're doing. But I think, I almost wonder if some of the sort of the way they handled that is with Scott and sort of making fun of him and the legacy of the iOS 6 UI. Is Apple, maybe they're not sure. Like, maybe there is a little bit of doubt that this major change in iOS 7 is actually right. And so the joking about the past OS is kind of like, they're almost like overcompensating because they're insecure. They're not sure if they're doing the right thing. And so they're sort of, it's almost like there's a scapegoat, or they're blaming, you know, making fun of the old decisions from this guy they fired.
Yeah,
because they're just not sure. They're actually, there's in the back of their head, they're not actually sure if they're doing the right thing with iOS 7. But more than that, they're not sure. I know Tim Cook is great about saying, we don't think about what Steve would have done. We just do, you know, he would have wanted us to just do what we think is right. But I think there's a lot, and I totally think Tim believes that and follows that. But I think there are people at Apple that do want to live up to, you know, what Steve wanted. And his like high standards of quality, and their way of sort of putting this on Scott is a way of saying is a way of forgetting that Steve may not have liked the new stuff, because Steve loved the old textures
yeah.
and that old part of the UI. And so by putting it all on Scott, they're basically giving themselves permission to ignore the fact that maybe Steve wouldn't have been happy with the direction.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And the way you were describing it, it's kind of like a confirmation bias type thing, right? Like you want to believe things that make your decision correct.
Right.
And I could see something like that being part of it. It's interesting you bring up the Steve Jobs thing, because I do think I think we even talked about this on the show years ago. But the guy, as brilliant as he was, and as celebrated as his tastes were, I remember thinking and even saying, I think on this show, like, he doesn't always have the greatest taste. Sometimes, you know, sometimes his aesthetic is, you know, and that's the way aesthetics are. They're not gonna meet everybody's approval. But I guess let's just say that I wouldn't have guessed that I would be so excited about Apple taking a direction that probably is a dramatic deviation from what Steve would have wanted. And so, you know, like before Steve passed away, everybody was fretting, oh no, what's going to happen to Apple without Steve? What's going to happen? You know, they're going to make all these decisions and do the wrong things because Steve won't be there to say, don't do this. And I'm actually in that position now where I feel like they're making the right decision because Steve's not there, mm-hmm. which is an interesting place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And it may be that it's taken kind of a year or two for them to be able to do that.
Yeah.
They have, you know, have enough distance where they can do something completely new.
Yeah.
I'm optimistic. I mean, I like the change. I was very surprised at first that they went this far with it, but I think there's a lot of neat concepts in it. So, phew, good luck to them. They have a lot of work to do.
They have a lot of work, and I agree a lot with people who point out that this is a very early pre-release. Mm-hmm. There are months and months and months to go, and also people who have pointed out how brilliant this is for something that was pulled together, as far as we can guess, in fairly short time. You know, like since I think the working theory is that basically since that shakeup happened and Forstall left, and that's been only like what, 8 months or something, 7-8 months. I think it's a pretty short period of time where essentially everyone was like, the whip was cracked, and everyone's like, you know what, we need an all new OS that puts behind us all of the affections we had for all of these ideas that are associated with the old guard. And to put that together in 8 months,
it's incredible.
It's an incredible example of it is extremely cohesive and well done for something that is sort of like snapped together like that.
Right.
And we'll see what happens over the next several months. I think what's going to happen now is we'll have essentially still that whip crack style of speed of development, and there won't even be an opportunity to sit down and like reflect patiently on whether some of the decisions ended up being perfect until after iOS 7 ships. So we'll have like something I think that's pretty darned usable as a final release, but I'm sure that iOS 8 and on will continue to refine that.
All right. Well, great talking to you, Daniel, and great to meet new folks last week. Any listeners who said hi, thank you for saying hi. It was great to meet you. And, you know, it was a good week. I'm sure we'll still be thinking and talking about this stuff over the coming weeks and as we get to play with the new stuff a little more from Apple.
Yep. It was great to see everybody, Manton. I'm glad we got to see each other a little bit more maybe this time than on average, which was still not very much, as it turns out. But it was real fun meeting a bunch of new people who are listeners of the show. My funny little passbook hack came up with some fun flypaper. The code name on the card was flypaper. I got people whispering it as they passed me. It was kind of fun.
Nice.
So cool. Thanks again, everybody. And Manton, I'll chat with you some more next week.
Great. See ya.